Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. So thank you. I'm Dan Gibbons from the City Club of Chicago, and it's wonderful to have all of you here. We're going to get to our conversation quickly. I do want to mention very quickly our sponsors, because we very much appreciate those who sponsor these programs and let us have these difficult conversations by supporting the City Club. And, of course, we have Cabrera Capital Markets, and you're going to hear from Martin Cabrera. Thank you. The Casey Family Programs. The Casey Family doing so much with foster care and with children. The Resurrection Project. Where's TRP? Right here. World Business Chicago. Welcome back. Adrian and Ellen and your team. Loyola University of Chicago is here. And they have some students with them, which we always appreciate when the students are here. Here we are. Lifting up this next generation of leaders. So excited to have you in the room, and hopefully we can engage you with a couple of questions along the way. We have the Consul General of Mexico is here. Ambassador Reina Torres Mendivil, thank you so much for being here. We also have the Consul General from Ireland, Brian Cahalain, is here. Thank you for being here and all the work you're doing. Marty Castro is here from Costa Central and former chair of the U.S. Commission on Human Rights. Jessica Redmond from Fifth Third Bank. Katya Nunca is from the McCormick Foundation. Katya, we're going to have a great program specifically about Little Village that we're talking about in a month plus. So keep an eye out for that. And thank you to Katya and to the McCormick Foundation for being such great partners in that and so much more. Another great partner is Gabe Lyon from Illinois Humanities. Thank you, Gabe. John Bracken is here from the Digital Public Library of America. Blue Pacheco Cornejo, building the Blue Azul Center. Jamil Abusab is here. Carmen Velasquez is here from Olivo. Clarisol Duque. From Senator Durbin's office, right in the middle of all these things that are happening in our country, in our city right now. And then we've got some other next generation leaders, Monse Ayala from Increase the Peace, Mackie Camacho from Metropolitan Peace Initiatives, and Christina Rice from Global Girls. As I said, we like to hear we're identifying and helping lift up some of those next generation folks that will be the next Resurrection Project or the next World Business Chicago, these next organizations that really do so much to lift our city up. So we always appreciate having those younger leaders in the room and encourage you all to keep coming and keep identifying folks to have in this room, because this is where it happens. We gather these amazing people together to move Chicago forward. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to have a conversation, and it's going to be about immigration, and it's going to be about the current state of immigration and enforcement and the impact on Chicago, on Chicago's economy, on Chicago's families. There's so much to talk about. I'm just going to ask our panelists to come up, and I'll give you some quick introductions on the way, because I think most of us know who they are. But please welcome Martin Cabrera. Martin's the founder and CEO of Cabrera Capital, a global investment firm here in Chicago. Illinois State Representative Degmar Avalar. D. Leader Avalar, thank you. She's been in the 85th district since she came from Ecuador at the age 12, a former dreamer. We're going to hear a little more about that. So she brings some personal experience and a real understanding of what it means and how that works, especially with government. Raul Raimundo, where is Raul? There you are. CEO and co-founder of the Resurrection Project. Which so many of us know, and some folks from your team here doing great things. So I'm going to sit down and join these incredible people, and we're going to get around to as much as we can. And I would like to get to questions, so I'll keep an eye on the time, and we'll do our best. So I'll move over here. Thank you all for being here. Make sure this works. And I just want to start by acknowledging how this came to be. At City Club, we don't know all that much, but we know the right people. And when we try to tackle issues, we call our friends, we call those who are the experts. And my first call after Actually, I called Clarisel Duque a while ago and said, how do we tackle this issue, right? And we had a great conversation, and then I called Martin Cabrera, and longtime friend of the City Club, and as you all know, so deeply involved in civic life, in the business community. We talked about the economic impact, but then so much more, and he helped me think this through and put together this panel, which we imagine is going to be the opening discussion of a number of conversations. There's no way we're going to get to all of this today or even in three different, you know, panels. So today was meant to set the stage and kind of give us a broad overview of where things stand today. It's a very dynamic, changing time. So we'll start with that and start with today. And I'd like to start with Martin by thanking you, first of all, for helping put this together and maybe get a couple thoughts in a general overview that can lead us into a discussion.
Sure. Thanks, Dan, and all of the folks at the club as well that have always been there and helpful. I think it's an important topic. I know we're dealing with it and hearing about it every day, not just here in Chicago and Illinois, but around the country. And, you know, we talk to a lot of different leaders, some of our U.S. senators around the country, some of our congressional members, but really try to look at what do we do? How do we come together to help bring some solutions? And I know it's not easy, and, you know, we're hearing all these stories of families being torn apart, and it's a struggle. Even as a business, kind of how do we help kind of bring together and with people that can come up with some solutions, our elected officials, kind of our civic leaders, our non-for-profits, but also our business leaders. And I think right now, kind of we've been trying to appeal to the humane side of things as a humanitarian issue, but it's not working. And so I think the narrative, we really need to look at it from multiple aspects and really trying to, how do we kind of impact things? Our Latino community, which is so important and roughly represents about 23% of the U.S. GDP and about $4.2 trillion every year, how is that going to be impacted? And it's going to be severely impacted, which is going to hurt our overall U.S. economy and everyone in this city, in this state, and in this country. So I think that's something that we really need to think about, because it seems like the president, that's the only thing he really understands is the economic side of things and doesn't really care about what's taking place with our families and folks in the neighborhoods as well. So I think we wanted to frame it in that aspect from multiple aspects, from elected official, from TRP's perspective. They're very involved as well. But to try to look to come up with some solutions and to look at multiple kind of areas, not just here in Chicago, but we always bring it back to Chicago and the state of Illinois and how is it going to impact our communities, and try to be active and proactive on some of these issues. So I think there's things that it's a tough environment. And I think back to like the Irish when they first came here in the 1840s and how they're being beaten in the streets, and, you know, they were saying they're taking all the jobs and how they were being treated very poorly. And I think our Latino community are the Latinos, are the Irish of the 1840s. And that is something that we're going through some difficult times. We're going to need to fight through and go through some brick walls, but it's going to make us better as well. I'm always looking on the positive, that the glass is half full, and we have to keep fighting and pushing to make greater change, to make things better for not just our communities, but like for our whole country as well.
Leader Avler, you're on the front lines of this, right? You're politically the state, the governor we're hearing from on a very regular basis. Can you give us, in this ever-changing dynamic, can you give us a current lay of the land, sort of politically and with state government and the city, and how things are going there?
Yeah, first of all, thank you, everybody, for coming today. To say that we have a plan, you know, the plans that we're having right now change every day, every hour, on the hour, depending on what we're seeing. I am a suburban representative. I don't represent Chicago. I don't represent Cook County. I actually represent the southwest suburbs in Romeoville and Bolingbrook. And the reason why I decided to run for office and got involved into politics and policy was because I was undocumented for the first 13 years of me living here in the United States, particularly in Illinois. And you know, just looking at what was the immigrant experience in an area where, you know, the EL students were about a dozen out of the whole entire student population. So I say all of this because we are seeing that history continues to repeat itself, just as Martin just mentioned. And what I keep thinking about every single day is, what is the role of government, not just state government, but what is the role of our federal colleagues in the current system that we're in? Because there's really not a lot that we could do when it comes to immigration reform. There's a lot of us who have been advocating for immigration reform. The truth is that when you talk about what is the meaning of reform, reform just means change. And we haven't seen some reforms that are actually vilifying and criminalizing a lot of our brothers and sisters who have been living in these communities for decades. So what is it that we can do? I can tell you that I'm very proud to live in Illinois. Illinois is one of the most immigrant-friendly states in the nation. There's a lot of states, and yes, we have to clap to that. And I say this because I think that that's also the reason why we're here today and we're seeing what's happening, because we have been victims of our own success. We have other states looking at what they can do to protect immigrant families. But then we are also seeing a federal government who's literally using taxpayer money for a reality show of the Trump administration. And that's just not right. It's just not right. So what can we do? I think that we are continuing to support a lot of the community organizations who are truly in the front lines, and I think Raul is going to be speaking to that, but continue to defend the legislation that we have been fighting for, not the last year, not the last 5 years, but for the past decades, right? Going from in-state tuition, which was actually the reason why I was able to finish college, TVDLs, right, for a lot of people. And yes, we have to clap for all of those wins. Temporary visitor driver's license that made our roads safer and secure because it allowed for drivers without a social security to be able to have a driver's license. We need to make sure that we continue to defend immigrants with the Trust Act. The Trust Act, and I thank the AG for doing this, but he's been litigating the crap out of it, and he's been winning. So that means that we are on the right path. So I'm here to be a vessel for change and to defend our communities at the end of the day. Thank you.
Thank you for that. And you mentioned reality show, but it is so much a reality, right? Every day this past weekend. Raul, give us what's the pulse of the community, and how is this affecting families? And it's all about people and community. What's going on in the community?
Yeah, so here's what we know. In the last 48 hours, we knew that ICE presence was coming. And in fact, it got announced that Midway Blitz is here. That's the official name of Department of Homeland Security efforts to increase ICE presence and begin to detain, in my opinion, indiscriminately and racially profiling immigrants as such. Right? That's what we knew. And so what we didn't know, which was chilling yesterday to hear, that the Supreme Court sort of allowed racial profiling to take place. If you are an immigrant, Hispanic, speak Spanish, and they can use that to come up to you and require your identification and eventually, you know, racially profile. That's what we didn't know. So this is just going to escalate what is happening in the community. The full force of ICE has not been present yet. It's just started. And there's also the challenge of the potential deployment of the National Guard, which has yet to happen. So those are the things that we know are coming. And so what's working and what the community is doing? First, I want to echo and thank all of the partners organizations, as Representative mentioned, who are doing incredible work in terms of what's working. What's working is know your rights, informing, educating folks about their rights. Because even if you are an unauthorized immigrant, you have rights. And there are lots of organizations that are doing incredible work across the state of Illinois doing this. And then there are networks that have, Illinois is one of the most organized states because of the leadership of the governor and the leadership of the state in terms of being a welcoming state and a welcoming city. Even the mayor and the governor are working together on these efforts, along with organizations, ICER, I see some of my colleagues from Enlace, BPNC. All of these organizations are plugged into networks already that are working to do know your rights. So that's one thing that's working. The second thing that we know it's working is rapid response teams. There's a lot of groups that are putting up their rapid response teams throughout the state. And if you don't aware of one, join one, because the way they work is as soon as they see some kind of activity going on, there is a network that sort of activates itself, goes to take pictures, goes to film, and in a sense puts public pressure to the authorities, and sometimes they go away. Not all the time, but sometimes they do. Those rapid response are really incredible that are working. And the third thing we know that is working and where we need more support is making sure that there are legal services to defend those individuals that are being detained unlawfully, in my opinion, or indiscriminately, in my opinion, because we know from data that the majority of immigrants being detained are non-criminals. An average 70%, 70 out of 100, quote-unquote, that they detain, feel, are non-criminals. Right? Many, and Mexicans primarily, are here and are unauthorized because of a violation of overstaying their visa, right? And so that is their only violation. They've been lawful individuals, raising a family, children of U.S. born, contributing billions of dollars into the taxes of the state, the national treasury as well, and so forth. So that's, and then lastly, what we also know, and this is sort of the challenge that we all have, is that there is a lot of anxiety on certain communities, right? This morning I was part of a Zoom call where, you know, a principal was telling me that they saw an attendance drop in their school in the last couple of days. And some of the parents calling her was because of the noise about detentions. There are hospitals, there's organizations. All is creating an anxiety on people who have vulnerable status. So that's one group of people. And then there's a larger group of people who are waiting to see, what can I do, where am I, right? And then fortunately, I think there's a bigger, larger people who, you know, this doesn't impact me, what should I do? I have some thoughts on that. So.
That's a great transition, because this does affect everyone. This affects Chicago. This affects our city. It affects our, obviously, entire country. But let's talk about the enormity. And I'd like to get to some personal stories eventually, too, where we talk about families and very personal and what it means for specific people. But let's back up. And Martin, maybe if you can, because you've looked at a lot of numbers and a lot of analytics, right, to understand what this means for the economy and what it means for the entire city. This is a lot bigger than...
Yeah, so I think there's the immigration policies, and on top of that, the tariffs that are causing inflation, and we're just starting to see it. So over the last 4 months, where every month they're projecting maybe about 127,000 jobs being created, only 22,000 are being created, or 26,000. So the economy is slowing. Because, you know, you need the workers, whether it's in agriculture, whether it's in construction, or whether it's in the service industry for restaurants. Mm-hmm. And you're seeing the AGC, which is the American General Contractors Association, they polled 1,300 construction companies. And 95% of them said that their projects are being delayed because they're short of workers. People are afraid to go to the workplace and do the work. So that's going to delay projects. It's going to cause kind of increases in prices. And it's the same that those, like, shortages of jobs because they're afraid to go into the workplace is going to impact everything we're doing. We're going to see it at the grocery stores. We're going to see it in projects for for cities, for states, for corporations as well. And even for Home Depot and for Target and Walmart, they're seeing anywhere between 4 to 18% decrease in their revenues. And that is hurting those companies, and they're going to start to, because of their revenues being cut, they're also going to look to have to cut jobs as well. So it's going to be a snowball effect that's impacting our economy. And I think part of it is having some of those businesses that need to call to the White House to let them know that their policies are impacting their businesses and it's slowing the economy. And, you know, even with those 1,300 construction companies, I think it was 97% of those companies said that they've had to increase their salary wages over the last year just to keep up with the jobs that they need because they don't have enough workers, they're not showing up, and people are afraid. And even to Raul's point, even when those parents are not taking their kids to school and they're keeping them at home because they're afraid that ICE may come and pick them up, when they're not in school, it's impacting the revenues that the states are receiving and giving to some of those local communities. So there's going to be more shortfalls at Chicago Public Schools, at some of the other public schools in the state, and throughout the country. That pressure is going to be felt not just in our cities, but also in some of the red states as well. And at a certain point, it's going to be boiling where they're going to have to speak up. I know a lot of those elected officials are afraid to speak up, but the pressure on Medicaid, on public schools, and the inflationary rates that are coming is going to all kind of come at once. And unfortunately, we probably need to feel some of that pain in order to get some change in policies as well. It's probably not good news in the short term, but it's probably what needs to take place in order for them to take a different stance, meaning the administration take a different stance on policy. And at the end of the day, it's actually our businesses and our economies and the workers that are needed. And immigration has been good, and the country needs to grow. But you need the workers in order to grow the country. And that's where the community really kind of comes into play, and the immigrant community, which has been a core of and the foundation of our country's growth, that needs to continue to be employed and to be safe.
And so are you suggesting that it's ultimately going to be the numbers that's going to wake people up?
I think it's the economy that the president and his team pay attention to. Mm-hmm. I don't think they really care that, you know, they're separating families and hurting so many individuals. I think it's going to be the businesses that are going to feel so much pressure and pain financially that they're going to be calling over to the White House or to the Secretary of Treasury to tell them to change their policy, that this is too hurtful to their business, to their economy, in order for them to see change take place. Because they don't really care that young kids are being separated from their parents. They don't, and it's unfortunate, but that's not really, it's not appealing. And we talked about it, even I'm Catholic, and those are my values, and that's who I know. It's like I have to do what's right, but we're hoping that all religions are stepping up more and really like putting pressure as much as you can from different aspects, not just the financial aspect, but every aspect that we can put more pressure for them to change their policy.
So pressure on elected officials, right? They're making the decisions. You're probably receiving some of that pressure. Could you tell us what you're hearing and what people are calling on you to do?
Sure. When you look at, you know, and I mean, we don't have to do a show of hands here, but I can tell you that the number one issue in the district that I represent has been an issue of affordability. Whether it is, you know, being able to buy a week's worth of groceries or being able to stay in their homes that they are increasingly seeing the rents going up and having to look at places elsewhere to be able to live. I think that it all comes down to affordability, which comes down to the economy, right? So as we are seeing all of these things, I think that it is important to continue to frame this as an issue where it's not just about the fact that when it comes to our values, yes, everybody should be treated with dignity and respect. But the pressure is truly going to be felt when that bag of potatoes is no longer $2.99, but it's $6.99, right? Because at the end of the day, what people are going to be seeing when they go back home is, I have less residual income to spend on the things that my family enjoys. And when you start taking that away, when I can tell you, when I door knock, the first thing that I hear is, how are my property taxes going to go down? How are you going to make sure that I have more money to bring back to my family and to bring food to the table? And immigration has a direct impact in that conversation, right? We're talking about immigration being the foundation of how this nation came to be, right? And we like to romanticize it, but a lot of the what usually doesn't get talked about is, you know, that, again, just history continues to repeat itself over and over again, and yet we are not seeing, you know, leadership from this current administration, and we're not going to see it, because at the end of the day, what they're doing is they are agitating their base, and their base believes what the administration says, no matter if the facts are saying otherwise, right? So I think that, do we need to see the pressure? Yes, we need to see the pressure. Most importantly, I think we need to see that pressure in districts where you had a lot of people voting for Trump. And if they are not feeling the pressure, and if they continue to be the majority at the in Congress, we're not going to get anything substantial done.
Interesting that you mentioned, you both kind of referred to the fact that this is local, but it does seem that it needs to be pressure in other states. And okay. And as most of you know, at City Club, we are not partisan. We're not biased any which way. In fact, we talk about the Trump administration. He was on this very stage, and it was 2015. I was watching it recently, and you better believe he was talking about immigration from day one. And you know, I want to first mention here at City Club that we do plan to incorporate other voices, and we do hear different sides. But there's no doubt that Chicago and Illinois is obviously very heavily Democrat, and I appreciate your point, Martin, that it's going to take some of these other states to really step up, because we've kind of understood that here. We know what's coming, and it is going to take some of these other states to understand that and help the whole country understand it better. But let's come back locally. Raul, if you would, talk a little bit about some specific examples of, you know, we get macro and micro. Let's go micro and understand where this is really where the rubber's meeting the road, and then maybe we could back out a bit. You mentioned you had a couple thoughts on the bigger picture economy.
Sure, I'll elaborate on micro, but I do want to look at the macro level. So, again, in addition to what Martin's saying to the economy, if you talk to local businesses on 26th Street, 47th Street, 18th Street, North Side, they're hurting. Their business is down at the local level. And so what does that mean locally for us? You know, 26th Street is known as the second magnificent mile in terms of providing tax base for the city of Chicago. Their business is going to hurt. It's going to hurt the tax base. That means it's going to hurt everything else where taxes go. That's one example, right, locally. In Illinois, we have about 2 million foreign-born immigrants or so individuals, about 15 to 18% of the population. About 550,000, 600,000 are unauthorized immigrants, right? Many of them are, their children are U.S.-born citizens. They've been working, you know, many years in their current place of employment because of their status. They're loyal to their employer, and they bought homes, and all of those things may come to a stop. Right? We've seen that. You can, if you're an immigrant, an unauthorized immigrant, you can buy a home with an I-10 number. And so, and they are paying taxes, about $1.5 billion in taxes that it is paid by unauthorized immigrants in the state of Illinois across the board.
So, can you repeat that number?
$1.5 billion. In the state of Illinois. Nationally, it's about $300 billion. Okay? So, nationally, at the macro level, what could we do? So, I agree with Martin that there has to be a step up from the other side. And I actually believe that progressives and conservatives have more in common than the far right or the far left. Okay? We just got to figure out on principle what we can agree on. Let me give you an example on this, right? I think on principle, progressives and conservatives agree that the border needed to be secured, right? And we all, I think, there. What we need to agree on is now the other layer, which is why we're here, is the mass deportation efforts, right, that are happening indiscriminately that we don't agree on because, again, 70% that are being detained are non-criminals, right? But we probably there are some agreement that they should pursue criminals, right? So there's a lot of, you know, things that we can agree in common about what is going on. We just got to figure out how to work together on that front. Nationally, we have 14 months to begin to change the trajectory of this country because of the November 2026 elections. The House is very evenly split. Only about 40 seats are going to be in play because of the gerrymandering, you know, fiasco nationally, right? And those are going to be very important seats. I don't think it's going to, the House delegation or Illinois or Senate delegation is going to change in Illinois. But we know where they are. All of us, all of you have networks, relationships in different parts of the country that you should figure out how do you begin to participate in changing the trajectory of what's going on. Whatever the parties are, you know, I do believe that we need to figure out that part. And lastly, we need to do it because here, I'm a immigrant myself, Mexican immigrant. Came here when I was 7 years old. The last time we had immigration reform was 1986. Yeah. Right? If we really think about it, that's the solution. Put pressure nationally to be able to really change what's going on right now. I, as a taxpayer of Illinois, right? Illinois is a contributor state. We pay more in taxes than we received, right? I had no say on this administration spending $140 billion on this issue. $40 billion on new detention centers, another several billion dollars. You know, I can only, if you talk about numbers, we should figure out where those dollars are going. Who are they going to? And as a taxpayer, I don't support that, right? And I think that's where the states and others need to figure out how to lift our voices and say that's not right. Mm-hmm. That us as taxpayers in Illinois are unfortunately, you know, getting shafted, if you will, by this administration. And imagine, and Martin, I think, alluded to, if we have immigration reform, that's the opposite side, right? The economy will thrive. We will have more GDP growth, more jobs, more safer streets, all of these things. So it's like the solution is there, right? So.
Yeah. If someone were to argue that the economy is doing just fine, how would you counter that?
I think the economy and the stock market has, like, even with the tariff talks, the stock market came down quite a bit and it's been rebounding. And I guess that is my fear for the 2026 elections, is that people will only remember what happened in the last month. And if the economy is doing well, if they're doing okay in their pocketbooks, I'm going to say, let's keep all these people in office. But when you look at the figures and everything from the increase in price for living, from housing as well as food, and even for gas, and gas come down a bit, but overall, the prices are going higher. Yeah. And we're losing jobs because the jobs are slowing. And it is a focus that the country needs to grow. And the country's growth has only been due to really the immigrant, the Latino growth aspect of it. When you look at the U.S. Latino, like, GDP, and it's $4.2 trillion, like, it's the third fastest growing economy in the world. It's China, India, then the U.S. Latino cohort. When you start to implement policies That's going to decrease the growth here in this country. And over the next 20 years, the net new homes being purchased by Americans are going to come, 70% of it is going to be coming from the U.S. Latino community. And this is going to detract that. So you're going to start to see that growth to slow. And that's going to impact the whole country, not just the Latino community, but the whole country. And it's something that the 2024 elections, the two most important things were the economy and the immigration issue. And we have to focus on the economy, and to the immigration issue, we have to look to find solutions. And that is something, it's not going to happen overnight, but that pressure is going to come. They're going to play hand in hand. They work hand in hand. And a lot of our Latino elected officials, I tell them, it's like, you don't have political power because you don't have economic power. And they come hand in hand. And our immigration issues and the economic issues are go hand in hand. And that's what we need to attack it, to really get some solutions. If that's the quickest way we can have some resolutions, then we have to look at how do we look at our economy and how we're contributing from a Latino community perspective, and how that's going to allow us to bring some solutions to overall immigration reform.
Did you want to add something? I saw you certainly nodding along there.
I just kept thinking about something that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, where, you know, when it comes to businesses, when you have a government that's unstable, where you have a policy that's put in place on Monday that gets rescinded on Tuesday, it's really hard for businesses to plan long term, right? So to me, that's a tax, right? And it doesn't allow for businesses to be able to thrive. So when we talk about like immigration and the economy being tied together, they have to be, and we need to continue to put that message that at the end of the day, when it comes to immigration reform, when it comes to how do we solve the immigration issue, we have to make sure that we're looking at both, not as different issues, but at issues that are intersectional with each other. So when we see a thriving immigrant population, a thriving Latino population as well, we are also going to be seeing a thriving economy.
So I would... the economy is working, but the question is for who, right? Mm-hmm. The lived experience of people on the ground are having a different experience under this economy,
yeah.
Right? Our previous administration, you know, boasted on the economy, right? But the people living it, the lived experience of people in affordable housing, affordable food, affordable daycare, all this stuff was not there. And I think that is happening right now as well. This new administration came in promising to address that. In fact, it's a exacerbator, as Martin has mentioned. So there is a window, I believe, and I'm optimistic about what is going to happen. History is on our side. And so I'm part of another organization called the American Business Immigrant Coalition. And there are efforts underway to try to figure out, because of this administration is overreaching. Right now, polls are showing that the majority of the public do agree with the border being secure, but not the way the mass deportations are happening. And so there is an effort to try to create a window so that there could be a fix for DACA individuals. I think most Americans, polls are showing that they support those individuals that are DACA already registered to be eligible for a path for legalization and eventually citizenship. And then there is the three service industry that Martin alluded to, service industry, agriculture industry, and construction industry, that there could be a window because the economy is in need of these services or these industries to create some kind of temporary opportunity of work status so that some of these families can have some relief. It's not going to come necessarily from the POTUS, if you will. It's going to come from the pressure from the ground, from the other legislators, that their constituents coming to them in red states, by the way, farmers in red states in Wyoming, Idaho, here in Illinois, and Indiana, who are saying, you know, we need a workforce that is going to help us. How does that impact all of you? Listen, compare your grocery bill today from a few years ago.
I think just, you know, even bringing it back home to Illinois, in Illinois, the U.S. Latino kind of buying power is about $101 billion every year. And when you see kind of the neighborhoods and back of the yards, Little Village, Pilsen, and other suburbs as well, where they're contracting in business, that means there's going to be fewer dollars spent. That means there's going to be fewer taxes being collected at the state level, which is going to cause more of a budget gap for the state. And the state legislators are going to have to make tougher decisions where to cut services. And that's going to be difficult. I think that's why it's extremely important to, you know, even banding together and some of the bipartisan organizations, even those on in the red states, to really come together to find solutions on a shorter term and longer term basis as well. Because we are going to feel it, unfortunately, at the city level, but at the state level and throughout the country. And it's not just some of those, it's the Medicaid, the Medicare as well, because they're suffering in some of those red states like Indiana and some and the other red states as well. But they're afraid to speak up. And it's going to get so painful economically that they're going to be forced to speak up. And we're hoping that it comes sooner rather than later.
So as I mentioned, the intention for today was to really set the stage for an understanding of where things stand and the impact. It's a little doom and gloom, right? This was not really a pleasant conversation to have. And I'd like to get to solutions eventually. I think that's going to be a whole other conversation. But what is Chicago and what is Illinois doing that the rest of the country can look at? Because you mentioned those three sectors, for instance, Illinois, service, agriculture, and construction. We're leaders in every one of those. There are plenty of examples here that Chicago has led the way for hundreds of years. What are things that could maybe come out of Chicago that we can be proud of and that the country can look at as an example?
I think it's already happening. I think the reason this administration is having a hard time with Chicago is because Chicago has a history of organizing, advocacy, and so forth. And it's synchronized because you have the leadership at the state level. The governor has been great in challenging the administration in being a welcoming state. Likewise, in the city of Chicago, the mayor has doubled down on having a welcoming city with its ordinance and so forth. And that fuels the rest of the advocacy community organizations. And what I've seen today from before is that there's more sort of networks coming together, organizing together. I mean, we may disagree on certain things, but on principle, we are in agreement. And so that's different from other cities, and that gives me, I'm actually full of optimism, full of hope, that this is just something that is coming by and passing by, but we have to acknowledge and work so it happens and passes by sooner rather than later, right? So it's not just the numbers and what's going to happen, but how do we participate civically and actively in the next frontier? Let me give you one staggering statistic, and this is for the Latino community that we need to figure out. Every year, there's about 1 million U.S.-born Latinos of immigrant parents who are becoming 18 years old. Right. I'm an immigrant. My daughters just became voted in the last presidential election, so they're part of that generation. Right. Every year, nationally, and for the next 5 years, that's the projection. So the Latino community is growing, and it's one of the fastest growing, as Martin mentioned, but also fastest voting bloc. But it needs to be activated more intentionally, nationally, locally, to begin to really exercise not just our economic power, Martin, but our political power. Yes. And that's what we all need to work towards.
I think, you know, to Raul's point, we're Chicago, we're Illinois, and when I say Chicago, it's a broader kind of Chicago land.
Yes.
But it really is the spirit of who we are. We lead. Like during the Daley administration, the current administration, Governor Pritzker, you know, Mayor Johnson and other mayors too. It's who we are as business leaders, as elected officials, as people of our community. And I think we've always been like that example that people around the country look towards. What are you going to do? And I think you see it, people stepping up now, and even with Governor Pritzker welcoming the Texas legislators to come here as well, and really to help organize, like, how are we going to take a better approach to this? But it is our leadership, and that's who we are as a city and as mm-hmm. leaders. And I think it is taking this crisis moment, and how do you turn it into an opportunity? How do you rally some of these younger folks to ensure that they're coming out to vote, that they're making a difference, not just here in Illinois, but in other parts of the country as well? And, you know, I go back to, like, my grandfather. My sister Tanya's here. My grandfather was born in 1918, and he was born just outside of Los Angeles. And in 1929, you had the Great Depression. And right after that depression, 1930s, they were saying that the Mexicans were taking all the jobs. So what they did, the president put a law out there to deport all the Mexicans. So there was 2 million people that were deported in California to Mexico. 60% of them were U.S. citizens. And my grandfather and his sister and his mother were the ones deported. He was 12 years old. And we just passed the bill last year in California to recognize that. And he came back to this country, and he wasn't upset about it, you know, which was amazing. And I, like, as I got older, I realized how much of an injustice it was. But even to recognize that in the history books, because even the Latino elected officials in California didn't know the history. But it's to recognize, and I thought that this would never happen again, but it's happening again. And not just our folks that are undocumented, but those that are documented, and even if they have kind of, they've been here and they're citizens now, they're still fearful. And that's not who we are as a country. And that's what we need to fight to change.
Yeah. Yeah. If I could sure. add on to the comments here, I just think about, like, yes, the silver linings, right? And we have a network of organizers that is more connected than ever, right? Whether it's through social media, whether it's through WhatsApp, Signal, text messages, the rapid response that's happening as we speak. And when I say as we speak, I got a text saying that, you know, ICE was at a certain place. Like, those were things that we couldn't do a couple of years back. For those of you that are publicizing the 855 Help My Family hotline from ICIRR, when we started the hotline, I worked at the coalition when we first started it, and it was under a Democratic administration. Right, and it was because we were seeing an increase in deportations of people in our communities, and we needed a place where we could start getting all that data. Out of the FSN, the Family Support Network, a lot of great things have come. One of them has been people have been connected to legal services, which we still need. So I know there's folks from philanthropy here. We need to continue to fund legal services. We talk about this time and time again. We can call, yes, we need to clap to that because we need that. I love due process, and I want to make sure that people get their due process. So we need to make sure that we continue to fund legal services. It's very helpful to be able to have somebody call a hotline, let them know about their rights. But when somebody has a father, a mother, a son, a child who is currently in ICE detention and they're nowhere to be found, their best option is to get an attorney to try to get them out as soon as they can. So legal services, legal support is needed. Another thing that I found from some of the calls that have been that the Family Support Hotline has been getting is just today or yesterday, they reported 500 calls within the last 24 hours, the highest numbers that they've had since January of 2025. And we're going to continue to see that increase. Something that I did not expect, but it makes sense. There's a real increase with regards to food access. People do not want to go to the grocery stores, even though they have the funds to pay. They don't feel like they are safe enough to go to the grocery store to buy food. and they are trying to access food pantries in a way where they don't have to go to the pantry itself. So for philanthropy, if you could please fund innovations to try to get food pantries to do things like, you know, something like Grubhub or like what the West Suburban Pantry does in my community, which is, you know, to get people to be able to order online so that a volunteer drops off food at people's homes, we need to continue to innovate. So I say all of these things because there's the organizing piece of it, there's the legislative piece of it, there's also the litigation piece of it, and, you know, for all the attorneys who are fighting the fight, I am there with you, but we also need to make sure that our safety net is also being funded appropriately.
There's the personal side of it, certainly, right? We're a few minutes over. I apologize for that. And if anyone does need to leave, I would like to take a few more minutes and see if we can get a question from the audience. Just keep with our city club tradition. So if anyone does need to leave, go ahead. Caleb is here, and he's going to have a microphone. If you have any questions, I tried to incorporate some of these submitted questions. We've got one in the middle of the room. Caleb, thank you. I hope you guys are okay with five extra minutes or so. Thank you. And if you could introduce yourself, please.
Well, first off, Mr. Gibbons, thank you so much for facilitating these important conversations. It's good to see you again. Well, first off, my name is Kevin Nguyen. I am an immigration social worker getting my master's and probably doctorate at Loyola. And I'm here with my students as well. First off, well, I want to speak towards Mr. Raimundo. I want to extend a personal thank you for my previous experience as a asylum seeker case manager at Heartland Alliance International. I worked with a lot of our survivors of torture, and I just want to say being able to refer my clients to you in confidence and for them to be granted asylum and helping with filing I-589 applications, that's in large part thanks to your org. So thank you.
I'll pass the thank to my incredible staff, especially our great leader, Danny Arredondo, doing this amazing work. So I will pass that on.
Yeah, thank you. And also, most recently, your staff helped with the Loyola School of Law in helping our institutional students know their rights. I don't remember which attorney, but I think it was Archer who spoke at one of our meetings. So my question for you, outside of what Loyola is doing currently, like, thank God we have an institution that's mission-driven, where we're supporting our students even now, even if behind the scenes. So we've been doing Know Your Rights, Red Cards, unfortunately, emergency family planning, because I think that's where we're at in terms of mixed-status families being detained and separated, and legal screenings, thanks to very generous pro bono partners. What can we do? My students, who I'm so proud of and in awe of for their resilience and compassion and strength, they're afraid. They're afraid to commute downtown to class. They're afraid to leave their res halls. They're afraid to walk around campus. They can't even get groceries sometimes, like going to Aldi. As a legal advocate, do you have any advice or suggestions for those of us who work in higher ed with these students?
I think it comes down to making sure that people have very strong relationships with each other, especially young people. And a personal one-on-one, right? Let's get beyond the internet so that there's empathy and support for one another. And I think when you see that happening in group settings, they begin to alleviate those fears that you're speaking about because it's a group, right? And so, and I think the other thing is to get them to focus on the future, right? We live in a world sometimes that we act like we live in the world as it should be, and we have to realize that we live in the world as it is and act that way so we can build that world. So how do you build, especially for young people, that they're and also how do you make sure that they are the most involved, if you will, or tolerant, that they are engaged as well with their peers. Loyola University is an incredible university, and it's not just a local university. It's an international university. It's a national university. How are they connected with others in other places as well? So I think listening and small steps, I think the young people will respond.
Thank you. I'll bring this back to me.
Can I add on to that? And let me try to make this story very quick. So when I went to college, I was undocumented. That was not a thing. The only thing we had was in-state tuition. And I remember my parents telling me, like, you have to get it done. Don't worry about what happens after you graduate. And we were right in the middle of the advocacy to get the DREAM Act passed. And I graduated in December of 2010. And I say this because it was a very pivotal moment in the DREAM Act advocacy, because there was important votes that were happening at that time. The day after I graduated college, the DREAM Act failed. And I remember just being in shock, because I thought we had it. And we almost had it. It was only by about 5 votes that it failed. And I said that I would not have been able to continue doing the work that I was doing, because I can tell you a lot of students that I went to Washington with who advocated for the DREAM Act, after that vote failed, there's just a couple of us who continue to do immigration activism work. So I think for you, one of the best things that you could do that allies can do is let people know that you are with them and to provide them the support that they need. From an Illinois legislative standpoint, we've also have great liaisons at universities that are helping students navigate this process. It was liaisons and it was the student community that allowed for the access legislation to happen. And when you said Tania, I was like, Tania's here. Tania Cabrera is here. I want to give a big shout out to Tania Cabrera with the Illinois Dream Fund, because it's been a lot of her activism, a lot of her wisdom, and a lot of her grit that has made a lot of resources available for students in higher ed. So I would say let them know that you are with them and to know the power of their story, because you never know where you might end up.
Thanks. Yeah.
One specific self-interest right now for students is that the Illinois In-State Tuition Act is under attack by the administration in D.C.
Yeah.
So how can our local leaders, state leaders, hold the line on that? Because that's going to impact a lot of individuals, particularly immigrants, if our current government at the state curbs. I don't think they will, but there's administration already in Texas. They eliminated the in-state tuition, and there are a couple of other states where they're doing so, and they're coming after the state of Illinois and others as such. So how do we get them involved?
Thank you. You know, we
absolutely.
Thank you. And thanks for the questions. As I figured, we could spend all month talking about this. And I do respect everybody's time. Maybe if I could ask a final question for us. I appreciate that everyone says, what can I do? What can we do? As we talked about, Martin, let's make this the first of a number of conversations. What can we do? What should we talk about next? And who needs to be? The stage is only this big. We need to have multiple conversations. We need to have the right people in the room. We need to have the right people participating in the conversation. Who, and maybe not specific names, but maybe organizations or more specific topics. I heard legal aid. We heard students. We heard mental health and how this affects kids and families, right? What are some of the things, if you could maybe close out by suggesting some ideas of things that we should be doing and talking about next?
I guess I'm a little jaded, so I know she's a good friend, Dolores Huerta, who's about 95 years old now. She's an activist, and I told her, it's like, Dolores, you gotta hit him in the pocketbook. So she actually went to go meet with the CEO for Target, and she had some choice words about him. And a lot of the Target revenues come from the Latino community here in the U.S.
Yeah.
But he failed to, like, really stand up for his clients, his customers that are creating so many revenues. And so she started boycotting him. And so, like, I was like, you need to make sure that everyone nationally knows that, if they're boycotting Target. So I actually jumped on my wife because she went and bought something for Target. I'm like, no. It's like we have to stand together as a community so that they do feel it and that they feel that pressure and that pain so that they're actually going to take a stand and do what's right for their customers, but also for the country. So I think that's what, like, I kind of focus in on that economic impact on what we could do. And how do we actually have people pay more attention to this issue and that they don't become numb to it?
Yeah. That's right.
Or be afraid to speak up.
I would love to have a conversation with the intersectionality between immigration and healthcare access. I think that that's a very pivotal conversation for us to have, especially as we talked about some of the policies that have passed at the federal level. I've been telling my constituents that I'm going to continue to talk about this over and over again because, unfortunately, we do have a short memory, right? Like, when we go to the voting booth, we'll probably remember what is happening at that time and not what is happening now. And one of the things that is going to happen in December, or actually November, that we're going to start hearing, as at least me as a legislator, is people not being able to buy insurance through the marketplace because the tax credits are gone, but yet the tax credits for billionaires are still there. So I think that for me it would be important to have also somebody who speaks to that, and seeing how is it that we could continue to have a conversation around healthcare access, because when communities are healthy, communities thrive.
I think there's got to be also an intersection of civil rights groups and immigrant groups. This is not just an immigration issue. You know, and I think the general public has to ask themselves questions, right? Do we want to live in a country where our civil rights are being violated on a daily basis? Do we want to live in a country where it's okay by the Supreme Court to be racially profiled? Do we want to live in a country where, you know, your taxes are going to, you know, do this kind of work, right? Especially from Illinois. And I think we need to figure out how to, that conversation needs to happen, as I mentioned earlier, the large majority of the population at the kitchen table, right? Because we know that the people that are impacted, they're the ones coming to our organizations, to our schools, they're impacted. And we know there's a lot of other groups we're waiting to see and support. But the vast majority of the population, you know, they're not feeling it, right? But I would tell you, as Martin mentioned earlier, slowly it's becoming more expensive. Slowly, if tax revenues go down, slowly if, you know, our economy suffers, they'll begin to feel it. But why wait?
Okay, I'm taking lots of notes here. Thank you. Thank you to the three of you. Thank you. We knew this was an unknown. We knew it was an unknown, and we knew there's so much more to come. And we didn't know today. We didn't know a month ago when we planned this what today was going to look like, and we don't know what tomorrow's going to look like. And I think we at City Club, as I mentioned, are committed to keeping this conversation going, and I look to all of you to help us do that and to keep coming, keep sharing those ideas, keep sharing these great insights, and folks who need to be in this room, because this is where you understand better what's really happening in our city and where we can help change the world, honestly. So please come back. Please, each of you, come back. We really appreciate hearing from you again. And to all of you, we have a whole host of programs. We're talking about the Architectural Biennial on September 11th, the Closing the Housing Gap on September 22nd. The Cook County Sheriff is going to be here, Tom Dart, on the 23rd. Commissioner of the Water Department on September 30th. Advance Illinois Report on Public Education, October 1st. Look at all these issues that were, I mean, this is one that's so gigantically important, but it affects all of these others that we're talking about too. And it's all a very interconnected web of civic leadership here in Chicago. So there's so much more to come. And I very much personally appreciate in these very difficult times, you taking your time out of the day to come here, share these thoughts with us, share your time with us, and please go about doing what you're doing and making the city a little bit better. Thanks again. You're welcome back at City Club anytime. Everybody have a great rest of the week. Okay.